I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The nearly 200-mile-wide Hurricane Ivan is threatening to strike several southern states later today as it heads towards the Gulf Coast with 140-mile-an-hour winds. Residents from Louisiana, Mississippi, and Florida are clogging highways in an attempt to drive north out of the possible path of the storm. Here's one resident of Mobile, Alabama, describing the traffic.
It took us 7.5 hours to go 82 miles. We've been on the road since 5:30 yesterday and have gotten just as far.
Well, officials in New Orleans warned residents there that Hurricane Ivan could submerge the low-lying city in 20 feet of water. Joining us on the line from New Orleans is Mark Schliffstein, a reporter for the Times-Picayune. And, Mark, we understand that that expected water level is one reason why the mayor didn't set up any shelters, you know, so that people wouldn't stay and possibly drown.
Actually, no shelters are allowed south of Interstate 10, on the which is actually on the other side of the lake, down into the city and south of here, for any Category 3 or greater storm, and rarely for storms even smaller than that, because of the danger of flooding. It just becomes very difficult. Even if the hurricane just brings in a bunch of rain, it can be very difficult. So the Red Cross has decided a number of years ago to stop doing shelters. The mayor now is struggling with whether or not to open up several buildings as what they call refuge of last resort. And the problem that he has is that there aren't many buildings in New Orleans that can withstand Category 4 hurricane speeds, even though it really doesn't look like we're going to get that high a wind here in New Orleans.
Well, you write that they might consider the Superdome.
Right. That is one of the places that they are looking at. They're attempting to avoid that because it's right now used as a special needs shelter, and it becomes sort of difficult for the personnel in there to handle both regular people and people with major medical problems.
Well, this is a city where a lot of people don't have cars. They use other transportation. The airport is closed. We hear several convention attendees were climbing to the top floors of their hotels and, you know, read articles about elderly people just sitting on the porch because they have nowhere to go and no way to get there.
That's very true. It continues to be a difficult problem, and both the community and the state and the federal government have not adequately addressed the problem of trying to get people out of New Orleans. In reality, it takes about 72 hours to do a full evacuation if everybody were to leave, and there really are no there's really no way of getting many of the 100,000 people who don't have transportation who live in New Orleans out of the city.
Yeah. We just have a couple seconds here, but what is happening now? Have most of the people who can go, have they gone?
Yes. As a matter of fact, the traffic on the highways leading out of New Orleans proper has really dropped off dramatically, although there's still bumper-to-bumper traffic to the west in Baton Rouge as evacuees make their way farther west. There's been a curfew ordered for 2 o'clock this afternoon for the city of New Orleans. Most highways will be shut down at that time so that, you know, people who wanted to leave should have left by that time. By that time, we're expecting to see at least tropical storm force winds going up to hurricane force winds later on.
And we understand that there's also going to be a curfew in some parishes where people can't get back in to avoid, you know, looting or other problems.
Right. And that's going to be a continuing problem. In fact, I just got a report that Louisiana 1 is already beginning to have water atop it down south of the city, and that's the major evacuation route for Grand Isle, a barrier island community. Most people in Louisiana are sort of inured to the fact that it will take a while for them to get back into their homes after a hurricane passes by, because high water will stick around for quite a while and will probably cut off a lot of roads.
Yeah. Mark Schliffstein is a reporter for the Times-Picayune in New Orleans, Louisiana. Mark, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay safe. Well, we turn now to Rob Hinchy of Alligator Point, Florida. Rob, you and your wife, Kate, own several beach houses along the shore there. You rent them out to friends and family. What's it like there right now?
Well, we have some wind, probably 25, 30 miles an hour. Most noticeable, though, our tide has begun to rise and surf is up quite a bit. We have a ground-level house, and so there is some risk from the storm surge. So we're picking up things on the floor and moving them up higher and bringing all our furniture in.
Yeah. Tell people about Alligator Point. I'm looking at a map. I see it's just a little bit below Tallahassee, but above Apalachicola. Tell us a little bit about it.
Alligator Point's a narrow peninsula that sticks into the Gulf of Mexico. It's a long, low peninsula.
And I'm sure, I'm looking at your website as well, a little bit of heaven for you. It just looks so barren. There's not a lot of tourist sites. There's just these homes right on the water.
Yes, that is the attraction, but right now it's the danger. We're very close to the water.
Yeah. What do you fear might happen? I'm looking at these houses. There's a beautiful one called Kate's Dream. I read that it was once all pink. If the winds rise the way they're expected to, do you expect the houses to be there?
Well, we're hoping it will. Kate's Dream's the one that we live in, and during Opal in 1995 was the last one similar as bad as this one. Water came through. Actually, some surf came through the house, knocked out doors, and damaged the downstairs where the house stood.
Yeah. What about the roadway, the access in and out? It looks pretty remote.
That's why we're going to have to be leaving in a couple of hours. It's already started to wash out, and there is only one road into here. And high tide will come later today, and at that point they expect the road to be completely washed out.
Yeah. What are your other concerns? Are there other people in the area? It sounds like you've retired to these homes that you once rented, but are there other people in the area that you are concerned about, elderly or others?
Sure. There are people who are new to the area and don't understand the risks and what to do about it. And we do have a lot of elderly and retired people here who need help boarding windows and getting out. Right now, though, we're getting pretty good support. I think that people will be all right here.
Yeah. You are an area, sounds somewhat the same as areas in Louisiana, for instance, where cities don't have shelters. Up here in the East, for instance, we're used to shelters every few blocks for people who live here. You don't have that. Where are you going?
Well, I have relatives in the area, and I'll just go inland to a relative's house. I believe there are shelters in Tallahassee, which is a little over an hour's drive away.
One last question. You know, we hear legendary stories about the people who stick it out. You know, they're going to fiercely remain in their house and ride out the storm, and in some ways in an exhilarating way. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think if you know your house and you know your area, that there may be reasons to do that sometimes, but where we have a road that's going to wash out, I just don't want to be trapped.
Well, Rob Hinchey, we wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
Rob Hinchey is a resident of Alligator Point, Florida. In the 2000 presidential campaign, candidate George W. Bush came under fire for his lack of foreign policy experience. Boston television reporter Andy Hiller exposed that shortfall during a 1999 interview. Here's an excerpt of his pop quiz.
Can you name the president of Chechnya?
No, can you?
The leader of Taiwan's government is President Lee Teng-hui.
Can you name the president of Taiwan?
Yeah, Lee.
Can you name the general who's in charge of Pakistan?
Is this 50 questions?
No, it's four questions of four leaders and four hotspots.
Bush later responded, he may not know everything about world affairs, but his team of foreign policy experts did. Well, former Los Angeles Times correspondent James Mann recounts that exchange and tells the story of those experts in his book, The Rise of the Vulcans, The History of Bush's War Cabinet, which critics call blessedly level-headed. Well, James joins us on the line. And can you start by telling us the name, the Vulcans, where did that come from?
The name came about because it was the nickname that Bush's foreign policy advisors during his first campaign for the presidency, the 2000 campaign, gave themselves the nickname the Vulcans. Why? Well, it has nothing to do with Star Trek. Mm-hmm. Condoleezza Rice came from Birmingham, Alabama. Birmingham's a steel town, and over the town is a huge Statue of Liberty-sized statue of Vulcan, the god of the forge. And they gave themselves this name. I think it was meant to convey the idea that, we're the tough guys, we're the durable ones.
And Condoleezza Rice, National Security Advisor, one of them, as you said. Who were the others?
Dick Cheney, the vice president, of course, the most Vulcan of all the Vulcans. Don Rumsfeld, the defense secretary, Secretary of State Powell, Deputy Secretary of State Richard Armitage, and Deputy Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz.
Yeah. Now, in your book, which is fascinating, you show how this group, in different ways and in different combinations over the past three decades, started forming its philosophy. Give us an overarching sense. What is that philosophy?
Well, above all, it places a premium on the importance of military power. These are people who all in one way or another had backgrounds, not necessarily in the military, but in the military or in the Pentagon. So there's really a Pentagon orientation towards their foreign policy. That's first of all, and a skepticism about the value of diplomacy, something that grows out of their experience in the Cold War. And the third common denominator is a desire to spread America's ideals overseas. And again, these are attitudes that, despite the many differences within the Bush administration, these are some of the core values.
Which is why the first pages of your book are so surprising. You describe a young Donald Rumsfeld, a thorn in the side of the Nixon White House. He worked there. Nixon calls him an anti-war activist on Vietnam, and Nixon talks about dumping him, maybe moving him to a post outside the White House.
I spent a lot of time in the Nixon library going through his famous tape recordings, and I found something that only a few people in Washington had realized before, which is that Rumsfeld was inside the Nixon administration something of a dove on Vietnam. There are a lot of possible reasons for that. He had no real connection to the war that would cause him to, you know, be defensive about America's involvement in Vietnam. He was also personally ambitious. Certainly the Kissinger people always thought that he was that Rumsfeld was looking for some way to challenge them, and being a dove on Vietnam was one of them. And he believed in domestic policy, so he thought the war was taking too many resources away from domestic policy.
Well, your book traces Bush's foreign policy advisors back 30 years to some very humble beginnings and some surprising connections. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll see how Madeleine Albright's father helped set Condoleezza Rice on her path. We'll hear how Dick Cheney spent some of his early political career trying to find the right salt shaker. And we'll continue our conversation with James Mann, author of The Rise of the Vulcans, in just a moment. Also, later in the show, a move to decriminalize prostitution in Berkeley and programs that teach kids abstinence. That's all coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We've been talking about Vulcans. Despite the music we just heard, these Vulcans are definitely earthbound. They're the group of foreign policy advisors President Bush brought on during the 2000 presidential campaign. And we've been speaking with author James Mann, who tracks their careers in his book, Rise of the Vulcans, The History of Bush's War Cabinet. James, we were just speaking about Donald Rumsfeld and how he came up through the Nixon era. Donald Rumsfeld also brought Dick Cheney into the fold, didn't he?
That's right. In fact, for several years, I call Cheney Rumsfeld's doorkeeper. He's the faceless guy outside the door who's taking care of administrative details for Rumsfeld.
And then how did he make his way up?
Well, he joined the Ford administration, again, under Rumsfeld as Deputy White House Chief of Staff. And he's the guy who really sort of learned the White House at the grunt level, at the first level. He's the guy who took care of salt shakers for the White House dinners, making sure that Betty Ford had a headrest on her helicopter, sending out the White House Christmas cards. And meanwhile, he's also the faceless guy who's in the office first, leaves at last, and taking care of all the administrative details. So people start to give him things like intelligence, because he's very he has this aura of discretion. And he gradually rises in importance, and until about a year before the 1976 election, his boss, Don Rumsfeld, gets appointed defense secretary, and they need a new White House chief of staff, and Cheney then in his young 30s becomes the White House chief of staff, and that's really his first major post.
Mm. I want to move to another one of the Vulcans, Condoleezza Rice, who was an intellect and one of the several intellects who made her way into this circle of advisors, Paul Wolfowitz being another one. She was influenced by a professor, Joseph Korbel, who was the father of the future Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, who he persuaded Condoleezza Rice to switch to international relations and Soviet studies.
It's an amazing coincidence. This was at the University of Denver. Rice, when she first entered college, was interested in music. And about after a year or two, again, at Denver, she's still a college student, she decides that she's not going to make it playing the piano. I think her words were, "I don't want to be someone who spends her life murdering Beethoven." And she's looking for a new field of study, and she decides on Russian Soviet studies. And the head of the department there, who really persuades her to switch her major, happens to be a Czech emigre who is Madeleine Albright's father.
Well, you also write about another intellectual who studied under Alan Bloom, the author of The Closing of the American Mind, and also became a follower of Leo Strauss, as you write, one of the icons of the modern conservative movement. This was Paul Wolfowitz, who became the Deputy Secretary of Defense. I want to just touch on one point that you make in talking about Mr. Wolfowitz, that this, as you call it, a contrapuntal campus movement in counterpoint to the anti-war movement, was more significant and had more of an effect on American policy than did the anti-war college movement.
If you look at lasting influences of intellectual movements on policy today, you'd have to say that with the power and the adventurism of the current Bush administration, that the strongest influence then would be the intellectual movement on which it drew, from which it drew, which is these conservative movements of the late 60s and early 70s.
We want to touch on Colin Powell as well. And your book shows that even as a soldier in Vietnam, he had a very different view of the military and the use of the military from the other hawks.
That's right. On the one hand, Powell shares with this administration a belief in the importance of the American military. On the other hand, the disagreement is how often and what circumstances you ought to use that that military power. And he represents a consistent streak within the United States Army, that the United States, while maintaining military power, should use it sparingly.
Well, so how did this group of people who have so many differences but have an underlying steely sameness in their thinking, how did that thinking of 30 years culminate in the war in Iraq now?
The war in Iraq is an example of this administration trying to reshape the entire security environment of the Middle East. It's a remarkably ambitious effort, and it follows this vision that grew out of the end of the Cold War in the first Bush administration.
Right. I'm wondering if you're thinking about how interesting it is that the candidates right now are finding themselves once again talking about Vietnam.
Yeah, I find it amazing. It's amazing. It's ironic. In some ways, you watch people's attitudes and ideas come full circle.
Couple last questions for James Mann. Do you think that if 9/11 hadn't happened, would the Vulcans have been able to implement their philosophies?
Yes, I think they would have tried. The emphasis was in a different place. They worked very hard and put a lot of effort into missile defense. They're still proceeding on that. I think their views, this view of an unchallengeable America, that you know, we would have seen this in some other place. And I don't think that it's just 9/11, because I don't think that the war in Iraq followed necessarily from 9/11. I think that the war in Iraq does represent the culmination of their views and ideas going back 30 years.
And we mentioned that the name of the Vulcans was chosen somewhat laughingly because of the statue that you mentioned, the iron statue that was in Condoleezza Rice's hometown. You tell, and that it was so strong and it was so well forged, and that's how they viewed themselves. What has happened to that statue?
Actually, in point of fact, it was taken down in the late 90s for repairs. I believe it's up again, but I'm not 100% sure of that.
But it wasn't holding up so well.
Right.
Journalist James Mann, author of Rise of the Vulcans, The History of Bush's War Cabinet. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Well, most of the pros are pro, but the neighbors are con. On November 2nd, voters in Berkeley, California, will decide on a ballot initiative that would essentially decriminalize prostitution by instructing the police to make enforcement their lowest priority. But even legendarily liberal Berkeley isn't automatically rushing into the arms of the world's oldest profession. We're joined now by Robin Few, the sponsor of the ballot initiative and herself a former prostitute. Hi, Robin.
Hello.
And also by Norma Hotelling of SAGE. That's the Standing Against Global Exploitation Project. She's against the idea of the initiative. And Norma, we welcome you as well.
Hello.
And Robin, to you first. It's your initiative. Police already turn a blind eye to a lot of prostitution. It's already a low priority. Why the initiative?
You know, we wrote this initiative because we wanted to restart a dialogue here in California. We felt that decriminalization is what we've really needed. In 1996, the Prostitution Task Force in San Francisco recommended it. Anti-prostitution women have been telling us for years that arresting women is not the answer, that we need to decriminalize prostitution. And we just thought that this initiative would be the way to get the dialogue started. This is just really, it is a symbolic initiative.
Well, Norma, if it's just symbolic, what's your opposition to it?
Well, I think that dialogue is needed, and we have wanted that for quite a while. But there's a way of having dialogue without promoting prostitution. And one thing that was left out in the introduction is that I'm also a former prostitute and worked on the streets in San Francisco for over 8 years, and actually came out of that arena and looked around, just kind of, I felt like I came out of a tar pit, and looked around, and all of the groups that are involved with Ms. Few, they were doing the same thing then. They were promoting prostitution. It's just a job. It's a victimless crime. Nobody gets hurt. And if you just decriminalize it, everything will be okay.
That's not what we're saying at all. And Norma, I think Norma's very clear on what we're doing. And, you know, I think that what's been the biggest problem about how this started was that the prostitutes worked on this initiative, and we brought this to the people. And for some reason, that has really disturbed people. You know, I guess we're supposed to wait for the politicians to do this. And we can't expect Norma to do it, because Norma gets a lot of funding every year to stop prostitution.
Why not, Robin, and we'll stay with you for a second, be right back to you, Norma. Why not just go for legalization so that there's regulation, so that women can actually be, as people in Nevada have said, made safer?
Well, because legalization is not the best thing for women. All these laws against women, the criminalization of this industry has all targeted women. And so that's why when we talk about prostitution, we talk about the women, because this is an issue where women are abused, violence is put to women, and this is what we want to talk about, the women, and bringing the women out and showing the women's voice and letting the women be heard.
Norma, never in the history of the world has tougher enforcement ever eradicated prostitution. Why not decriminalize for the reasons Robin's saying?
Well, I think the one thing that we agree on and is part of this initiative is that for women it should be decriminalized. But what also folds into this initiative that doesn't get talked about is the decriminalization of the men, decriminalization of pimps and traffickers. And we have not had any dialogue or debate around that. So if it's just about women, then that's what the initiative should be clear about. But I'm not hearing ever the addressing of the demand or the pimps or the traffickers. And I want to clear something up. Our program is about healing the wounds, and we have the walking wounded. Fortunately, they're still walking, and they're able to access our services, walking through our door every single day. And we meet hundreds of women per week that have such deep traumatization, hurt, and pain. That is from lifelong histories of sexual exploitation and violence, and the end of that continuum is very often prostitution.
So before we let you go, Norma, because we're going to bring someone else into the conversation, do you think there's ever a way that there should be prostitution, or are you against it completely on moral grounds?
I'm certainly not against it on moral grounds, but I'm against it on women's rights grounds. I think that prostitution hurts women, hurts children, and what we see in legalized and decriminalized areas is a huge explosion in child exploitation, trafficking in women. The original thought is the women want it. Let's do it for the women. And then everybody is ill-prepared to deal with the money laundering, the Asian gangs, the other types of gangs that get involved in this. They're all throughout the Netherlands, and the legalized system in the Netherlands does not protect women.
Well, Norma Hotelling of SAGE, that's Standing Against Global Exploitation Project, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Well, we're joined now by Muhammad Al-Kasari. He's a Berkeley resident who works in a store that's right in the heart of Berkeley's San Pablo Avenue red light district. And Muhammad, your thoughts, first of all, if the initiative passes, what effect do you think will have on your neighborhood?
Well, then you're going to see more prostitution. Then it's going to see like more Las Vegas and all this. I mean, nobody likes to see prostitution in front of their house. My kids, I don't want them to see it. I don't want to see other kids to see it. Hang around, people drop them off, you know, back and forth and hustling. I think it's ridiculous. I've been here in this business and this location for 14 years, and it's getting worse. It's hurt our business, and you don't believe that they hurt even the women's itself. I mean, I don't know who people are talking about, women's rights, women's rights. I think they hurt women. They destroy the dignity of women, actually. If they're going to just let the women do and sell their body, if they want to do that, let the city lease their own buildings and make it for plus prostitution. Let them pay in taxes and do whatever they want.
Robin, if you bring you back in the conversation, what do you say to that? This will actually hurt business, hurts the women, as you heard both Norma and Muhammad say, and we've heard other residents say that it's, you know, it's just a nuisance to people who live there. It's not something people want in their neighborhood.
What I can say is I'm a neighbor of Muhammad's. I live right up the street from him, and it's been really funny to me to hear this, all this hype talking about Berkeley streets being littered with needles and condoms and prostitutes. It's just not true. And Muhammad can tell you that we live in a beautiful city, and he doesn't have a lot of of horrible things happening right there in front of his business. But there is the occasional prostitute. It does happen. And the police have said within the last 3 years that prostitution has increased on San Pablo. And yet they keep continuing to arrest. And they go in and arrest and arrest. And it is not stopping it.
Mohammed, one last thought from you. Do you think the people of Berkeley should decide whether or not prostitution is decriminalized?
Well, sure, as I said. I mean, but I believe myself they're going to go against it.
Mohammed Al-Kasaria lives and works in Berkeley, California. Robin Few is with SWAP, the Sex Workers Outreach Project. Thank you both for talking to us about it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Here and Now. The Secretary of the National Guard Commander, said to have written those damning documents about George Bush's guard service, now says she never typed those documents and believes them to be fakes. But, she says, their content accurately reflects the content of other letters she did type for Lieutenant Colonel Jerry Killian about George Bush. Well, as the controversy continues over the critical papers, executives at CBS say they stand by their contention that the 30-year-old documents, publicized by news anchor Dan Rather, are authentic, despite a growing body of evidence that they are not, which raises a lot of journalistic questions. And here to help us answer them, Kelly McBride, part of the ethics faculty at the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg, Florida. Kelly, as you know, Dan Rather issued a very strong statement. CBS has also issued a strong statement. As the evidence about the documents came in, is there some other public face that CBS could have put on?
Well, one thing that I think they could reveal is a little bit more information about how they got the documents, where they came from, and what the motive of the source who provided those documents to the newsroom might be.
Should they have, as some are saying, have immediately said that they would launch an investigation?
Well, presumably they did the investigation before they aired the information.
Mm.
And I guess that's why they're in such a tight spot now. As journalists, we are responsible for thoroughly vetting any information that comes to us to make sure it's true. And CBS claims that that's what they did. But as we're seeing, there is enough evidence out there to question the authenticity of these documents that perhaps a second review is merited at this point. I think the other question that if these documents are proven to be false is going to be, how did they get into the record? Because the documents are in the official Pentagon records right now. The White House released them. So if they do turn out to be false, it's going to suggest some type of deep-reaching conspiracy, really.
You're saying that CBS got these papers somehow from the record. I mean, it wasn't as if someone took them out of their desk drawer. They were in the White House record.
CBS got them from a confidential source, as did a couple of other newsrooms. I believe the Dallas Morning News and the Washington Post. The White House released the documents after the CBS report and said, oh, yes, these have turned up in the official records request for President Bush's National Guard history.
Doesn't that take some of the pressure off of CBS?
Well, no. You know, even if the government, I mean, the government's been known to give out disinformation.
Right.
As a journalist, you've got to question information from the government as much as you do from a confidential source.
And as a journalist who's watched these stories, in 1984, we had the publication by Newsweek of diaries of Adolf Hitler that turned out to be forgeries. There was the Tailwind scandal at CNN. They hired an outside lawyer to investigate.
Mm-hmm.
In all those cases, somebody was fired, somebody quit. Do you think we'll be seeing that here?
Boy, I'm not sure. I'm really not. It's much too early to tell. It's possible that CBS did do due diligence, but the setup was so thorough that you couldn't assign culpability. It's possible that they didn't do due diligence on researching these documents. When you line up all of those publications of misinformation, what you look at is a system within journalism that needs some type of internal accountability, a method of going back and checking.
Kelly McBride, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Kelly is with the ethics faculty at the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg, Florida. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
We will double federal funding for abstinence programs so schools can teach this fact of life. Abstinence for young people is the only certain way to avoid sexually transmitted diseases.
President Bush taking a stand on abstinence at his State of the Union address in January. The current administration is the friendliest ever to abstinence-only education. In the past 2 years, it's given more than $1 million to one group alone, a high-tech Christian roadshow from Pittsburgh called The Silver Ring Thing. The show uses special effects, techno music, and comedy sketches to convince teens to take a vow of abstinence until marriage. In part, it's using its federal windfall to set up regional hub offices in 75 cities over the next 7 years, Boston being one of the first. Sean Cole of WBUR's documentary unit Inside Out has been tracking the birth of Silver Ring Thing New England. In the first of three stories, he follows the group's program director, Joe McGarry.
I sit down with Joe 3 weeks before his first show as program director, and it's instantly clear why they hired him for this job. Joe McGarry is the coolest Christian you will ever meet, especially if you're 16 years old. He's got spiky two-toned hair, three earrings in one ear, two in the other. He's got patches of his favorite hardcore band sewn to his shoulder bag, The Misfits, Rancid, Minor Threat. He says things like this.
Christians have a terrible history at times, you know, and much to be ashamed of.
And this.
Golly, I mean, I think like Marilyn Manson. I think no wonder he hates Christians. Christians are jerks to him. Yeah, that's great tape.
All of which kind of belie the fact that he carries a Bible in the front pocket of his shoulder bag, and when he's asked to read the verse embossed on the special silver ring thing ring, he knows just which page to turn to.
It just says, it's God's will that you should be sanctified, that you should avoid sexual immorality, that each of you should learn to control his own body in a way that is holy and honorable.
The ring is a symbol of an abstinence vow. The kids put it on at the end of the show and read the pledge out loud from two enormous video screens. Silver Ring Thing says it's christened more than 20,000 fingers with silver rings since it began in 1995. It started small, with a bunch of TVs and a couple lighting trees. Now the show is an epic of technology. Part rave, part Saturday Night Live, part Saturday Night Revival Meeting.
Everything changed after we had sex. The relationship just got too intense.
Did I tell you I had syphilis?
In signing this covenant before God Almighty, I, Jordan, agreed to wear a silver ring as a sign of my pledge.
Kids who attend Silver Ring Thing are told sex is great, but that having it outside of wedlock can lead to sexually transmitted diseases, unwanted pregnancies, and torturous breakups. They're told condoms are no answer, which is where those who oppose groups like Silver Ring Thing call them on the carpet, saying they censor vital information that can save kids' lives. Over the past few years, the show has traveled all over the country from its home base in Pittsburgh. But now it's setting up little abstinence franchises, like the one here in Boston, which is where Joe McGarry comes in. His job ranges from figuring out how to get 2,000 Bibles shipped here from the Midwest.
Are these Bibles going to be palletized?
To working out rehearsal schedules.
Jess! Oh, crud, I'm getting a call on another phone.
It's just Melanie. Call after email after call. This is what his cell phone sounds like.
Get up. Who's calling me?
It's Sex Machine by James Brown.
Stay on the scene.
Yeah, Sex Machine. Abstinence.
And he doesn't have an office yet, which is why we're meeting at Perks Cafe in Norwood, where he lives. I came prepared to ask Joe what it was like to be abstinent until marriage. But Joe wasn't abstinent until marriage. Not the whole time. He lost his virginity at 16 to a girl who eventually tore out his heart, as he describes it. They were together 3 years before she left him to be with the guy she'd been sleeping with behind Joe's back. Joe had already been regretting the sex they had together because it went against his faith. And after a few more failed relationships, he decided to become abstinent. His wife, on the other hand, was abstinent until they got married. I asked him how they dealt with the libido factor while they were still dating.
We set up rules, you know. After kitchen dinner and a movie, I drop you off, and it's a 2-minute drop-off, and then I'm gone.
And forgive me for asking this, but, are you kissing during these 2 minutes, or is there...
That's such a bizarre way to ask the question.
I'm sorry.
It's no problem. Not through the solid 2 minutes.
Okay, go.
Exactly. We got 2 minutes to go.
I got a stopwatch here.
The general rule of thumb, anything that we would cover is covered for a reason. And so being absent means that you leave it covered. Any other stuff where you would say, you know, you're kissing or you're whatever, holding hands stuff, that's fine.
Mysteriously, I transform into a 16-year-old boy and ask if that means you can touch someone above the clothes. Joe says once you start asking questions like that, you're approaching the issue from the wrong direction. He says abstinence, or at least Silver Ring Things brand of abstinence, is a spiritually motivated decision, and that sex outside of wedlock can do actual spiritual damage to a person.
You know, there are aspects of my soul that are traveling around with other people, you know, forever, and I can't do anything about that.
I mean, you're saying that you've kind of given these women your soul because through the having sex with them.
Yeah, oh yeah. The best illustration I had of it is if you were to picture going out to a flagpole in the middle of January, in just the coldest day of the year, and get your tongue nice and wet, and you stick it on the flagpole. Your tongue is fused. Now rip it off. That's kind of what happens when you have this sex in a non-permanent relationship.
That's the most unpleasant description of sex outside of marriage I've ever heard. That's amazing.
I think that's what happens. From my own experience, that's what happened to me. But God says, I created you to never know that pain. I created you to know the joy and the wonder and how amazing sex is. And how fun it is, because that's something Christians don't talk about that much either.
Later, we drive to a church in Easton, where Joe will tell a group of 12 to 17-year-olds how fun sex is. When they're finally corralled into the main part of the church, Joe gets behind the podium, and right away he's in his element, loosening up the crowd with a couple of jokes. As it turns out, though, these kids don't need much convincing where abstinence is concerned. A lot of them took the pledge when Silver Ring Thing traveled here from Pittsburgh.
You guys must like it when Silver Ring Thing guys come into town because it's just sex, sex, and more sex, and it's kind of fun, right? Woo! I got two things that if you don't come away with anything else, I want you guys to come away with. First is this. Sex is good. Sex is great in the right context. Sex is the best stuff on earth when in the right context. Second thing, in the wrong context, sex can be one of the most damaging things that you'll do to yourself. And it'll be one of the most damaging things you can do to another person. Apart from not turning off your cell phone at very deep moments. How rude. That's my mom. Shh, Mom, I'm talking about sex. No, it's okay. It's at the church.
I'm probably twice as old as the oldest kid in the room, and every time Joe talks about how great sex is I get really uncomfortable. Maybe it's the euphoric look on his face when he says it, or maybe it's the fact that some of these kids seem impossibly young. But most of the kids are pretty riveted, especially when Joe gets to the part about the flagpole.
As fast as you can, because it doesn't count if you do it bit by bit. Pull it apart. Right? Guys, this is what happens. This is what happens to your soul.
It's an intense half hour, but when it's all over, all the kids want to know is whether there are any spots open on the crew for the upcoming show.
I need 3 camera operators, and I need a... Look at those. Those hands are picking up.
Finally, most of them tear out of the room to play some more. And when we catch up, everyone is all hopped up on cake and soda, and they're bouncing off the walls of this little recreation building across from the church. They're hurling ping pong balls at each other, popping balloons. 3 of the boys pick up one of the boys and start carrying him around. It's total mayhem. And at this moment, it seems like sex is the furthest thing from their minds.
Sean Cole of the documentary unit Inside Out. Tune in tomorrow for part 2 of his examination of the abstinence-only program, The Silver Ring Thing. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Get into your radio and join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.